Hey yo, and here we go. Another episode of We Talk Music is on the air and in your ear. I am Mo, and of course I'm joined by the King of the Casters, Mr. Brett Podcast. Brett, who is our special guest on this day?
Oh, well, we have a special guest that I've been listening to for a very long time. He is one of the most underrated guitarists of all time, an amazing, amazing player, and just, you know, top-notch musically overall. He is Frank Marino from Mahogany Rush. Frank, so happy you could join us.
I'm very happy to be with you.
You know, it's kind of funny, Brett mentions off the top one of the most underrated guitarists. I don't think you feel that way, though. Because within the industry, your influence is felt and is talked about by other musicians.
I think he's probably a lot. Someone made that point just the other day online, actually. It's interesting you're saying that to that word, because there was somebody that said, I think he means underpromoted. That's what a guy said. No, really, someone said underrated guitar player, and then the other guy clapped back, no, I think you mean underpromoted. So I think that's the point you're making there. Yeah, I get what it means. I get what he means.
Yeah, and no,
I'm not a mainstream, you know, my name isn't like known in every household type of thing, but among guitar players, I guess it is. So it's more like that kind of thing. The industry never really promoted Mahogany Rush, you know, very, very much. I mean, we did what we could, but hey, we managed the last 50 years, guys. So, we're doing something okay.
Well, and that's it, right? Like, I mean, I guess if you had to make a choice, being well respected by your peers, but also surviving for 50 years, what a fantastic career! Could you ask for more?
Well, look, you know, you know, when I started 50 years ago, I mean, really, it was just like, you know, let's do this because it's fun to do. We didn't really, you know, I didn't know at the time I'd end up in a career and be still doing it 50 years later. Although if you'd asked me then, would you like to? I'd have said, yeah. So it just sort of worked out, you know, pretty symbiotic, but I'm just grateful, you know, that I've been able to do what I've done for all my life and not have to do other things. Some guys have been harder lives than me, so I'm pretty grateful for that and be with music all the time.
Now, one of the reasons that we're here talking to you is because you've redone the Live at the Agora Theater Blu-ray DVD, and I mean, what an amazing piece of material. 6 hours. Like,
it was actually 12 hours. But it's been cut down. You know, we put 6 hours there. But the day was 12 hours, and then there was 7 hours the night before during what we filmed the sound check and with the audience. So it was a little more than what's there, but still what's there is quite a bit. And that basically came from the fact that I wanted to, at the time when the video company had said to me, they, you know, talked me into doing a video, I said, okay, you know, been talking me into it for a long, long time. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to just do as many songs as I can in a whole day rather than do, you know, a short, here's our video type of thing. And that's how it became this long, long video, but I'm pretty happy with it. You know, I think it's a really good indication of what the band is. If you see the band, you know, if you go see the band, it's pretty good indication of that.
You did the editing for this largely yourself, didn't you?
Yes, entirely myself.
Entirely
not the
yourself.
Not the initial. Well, there's editing and there's editing, because there's video editing and there's audio editing. And video editing is when the shots change, and audio editing is obviously the mixing and the sound. But as far as the audio editing, I did everything. But as far as the video editing, the director edits the video when he's calling the cameras. So, for instance, you know, he's sitting behind the scrim there, and he's got like a headset, and he's talking to, you know, seven camera guys, and he's going, camera one, turn on, you know, this guy, go here. And he's calling camera shots, much like when you watch a hockey game. And that's sort of printed as the final edit of the video. But what you know, each camera is recorded to its own track. So what I did in terms of my, you know, contribution to the video part of the editing was when he's calling out those changes, a lot of the times he doesn't know, let's say, that the singing is about to happen or the guitar is about to do a solo. So his calls might be a little late, or he might pick up a different camera, or he might be on one camera while something else is going on. So I took it back in at that point and said, well, let's just tighten up what he did, because you can always recall what he did from the original cameras. So in a sense, I did the post editing of the video. He did the direction of the video, video shoot. But then there's the audio, which is a separate thing. And so that I had to do, you know, which took me a long time because there were some damaged files, and it took a really, really long time to fix them. And that's in the book. There's a book included with the package that basically the last 20 chapters, which I wrote, explain all of that.
How many man hours then do you think you put into this, or is it almost impossible to count?
I put years and years and years, and literally every day of those years. It wasn't something I did in the spare time. I didn't say, well, you know, I think I'll go work on that video today because I have something to do. I really did nothing but that for many years. And it's because the damage was so bad. You know, had I not done it, well, it just, you know, plain and simple, just never would have come out. And, you know, it would have been, listen, if it never came out, it never came out. I mean, it's not going to change the world that it did come out. But I felt a gratitude and a kind of a duty to fix what I, you know, what I said I would. I mean, I had originally, when I found out it was broken, I said, well, I'm going to fix it. And, you know, I was very grateful that these people did this video for me. And I was very grateful that I'm a religious guy, so I look at it as a gift from God. So I was very grateful for that. And then when you find out just how much work it is, you can't just turn around and say, well, you know, I don't really have to fix it because it's worse than I thought it would be. So I just stuck with it, and it just ended up taking a very, very big part of my life. It took me out of the industry entirely to only this. So now that it's, you know, once it was finished, anyway, the book really talks about that. So once it's finished, now it comes out and, you know, people are calling again and you want to go on tour and do you want to, you know, what do you want to do? So we continue from here, you know, God willing.
No, and I see that you've got some tour dates booked up in 2020. So that's really great news. Hope that you'll get a chance to come over to Calgary sometime.
Well, you know, it's been such a long time since I was there, and I really want to go. That whole area, as you know, Canada is such a wide country with very, you know, there's not a whole lot of cities on the way, and so the only problem that we have with whenever we try to go west is because we're usually going west in the top of the United States, and even then, there's very few cities that a band like ours will end up playing in, you know, on the west, because there's not that many in a row. And then we can't cross back into Canada because we've got, it's a whole working papers thing where we have to get into tour in the States. And then if we cross back, then we can't get back in. It's like a whole complication.
Wow.
So I've always said for so many years, why am I a Canadian who plays so few Canadian dates? I mean, by comparison, I'm quite the Canadian, actually. You know, like I really am. And you know, I'm a hockey fan and everything else, you know. But it's weird. It's always been that way. It's I've never understood it for a half a century. But I do remember playing the Alberta Jam. I remember playing Calgary. I remember playing Edmonton a couple of times. But when you have to remember back over your career and it's a couple of times, I think there's something wrong there. It's not like I've been around for 2 years, you know? So I'm always saying that to the booking agents, because I don't book shows. I mean, I never, you know, the band doesn't plan where they go. I know kids think that. They think, oh, the band didn't come here. They passed up on our city. It doesn't work that way. It's buyers, it's promoters who call the band through an agent and say, we want to have you. And if they don't call, there's no way you can ever get to that city. You'd have to do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm always hoping it happens, man. I really am.
Yeah, I mean, it must be so difficult because even then, even if it's one show, like, it must be so hard to just go out and do one show, because often I would expect the money just isn't really worth it to do that. You have to be able to do multiples.
You know what? Yeah, it's not even a question of worth it. It's a question of possible. So, like, here's the way it's got to happen. No matter where a band is playing, okay, so this applies to Calgary, it applies to anywhere, okay? A promoter in the area will decide, I will hire or buy or whatever that group for a show. He will then contact that group's agent or manager or even the group themselves directly. And they'll say, do you want to come and play? I'm ready to buy a show. Whether he contacts them directly or it's through an agent, either way, that connection is made, but it is made by the promoter. And sometimes an agent for the band will contact promoters that they know in a given area and say, we need a date on a Tuesday or a Wednesday or a Friday because we're passing by. Do you want to do one? And so that promoter will either say yes or they'll say no. And when they say, well, if they say no, you're just not going there. If they say yes, then they'll tell you, well, this is what I'm prepared to pay for it. So nobody comes back to the band and says, oh, you know, do you want to go there? This is what they're going to pay for it. And the band says, nah, it's not worth it. That's not how it works. It's like we can't do that particular place because it costs more to go there than it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So what ends up happening is, no, you start routing over to do that or do a one-off and then routing back to where you were. It's like you're actually spending money to go there. So that's why you end up not going, and you say to yourself, well, maybe next year the promoter will offer, you know, enough. They don't even, a lot of the times they won't even pay what it costs you when you don't show up in a city, because I don't know too many bands that will refuse to play in any city or to go anywhere. They'll always say yes. I've never heard of anybody saying, nah, we're not going to go there. You know, just because of where it is. It's usually because it can't happen. Now, there may be some that will say, I won't go somewhere because they're not paying me enough. Because they, you know, there's a lot of big-headed guys in our industry that think they're worth more than they are. But that's not usually the case. Usually it's just a question of logistics and routing and whether it makes sense financially. So I've always hoped that, you know, I'm a Canadian, and when I started in 69, 70, you know, all I did was play around the province of Quebec, where I'm from, and the fact that I didn't even speak French, and yet here I was playing mostly in the province of Quebec, and the French people were supporting me very, very much. And so I never understood why I wasn't getting gigs as many in Ontario and Manitoba and Saskatchewan and Alberta and British Columbia. And even to the east, I was never getting that many gigs in these places. And we got some, but not a lot when you think about it. And we'd wait years sometimes before somebody would say, yeah, let's try Mahogany Rush. I think I went out and played with Nazareth there, and I remember playing a few festivals. It's always more likely you'll get a gig at a festival because the festivals have bigger budgets. And so they'll offer to be able to pay for the band's expenses to go. But it just really bothered me, being pretty pro-Canada as I am, that I never played a whole lot in Canada.
Well, I remember when I first started listening to Mahogany Rush and actually completely thinking that you were an American band.
Oh, yeah, I got that. Yeah, a lot of people think that. A lot of people thought that and still do.
Mm-hmm.
And I still live in Montreal. I always did. And, you know, even, look, there was a point, guys, when I was touring 200 days a year, 300 days a year, and all over the world. And if I, any off time I had, it was still I'm back in Montreal. I didn't, you know, that's where I am. It's where my parents are buried. It's where I'll be buried. You know, it's, that's what I am. And it is odd. A lot of people thought, there was a guy on the internet that wrote something. I don't know where it came from, but the Wikipedia or something had me born in Del Rio, Texas, and then I was like, you know, in 1932 or something, 1940. I don't know. It was ridiculous, you know? Because we didn't, we're not a group that had, like, you know, I used to call it the shiny background. Like, we didn't have, like, the publicist and, you know, the teams of people taking care of your stuff and all that stuff. We didn't have that. Even though we were on a major label, we didn't have all of that tinsel, you know, on the tree. And so if you don't have that, if you don't have those publicists, if you're not, if that's not being done, that's why I said the word, underpromoted. You become underpromoted. And one of the bad things about being underpromoted is people don't know a whole lot about the truth. They start, people will invent stories into where there's a void because no one's telling the real story. And I think that's pretty much why people in Canada thought I was American.
You know, it sounds like a double-edged sword. I mean, if you don't have the publicist and the agent and all this stuff to promote you, you don't get out there. You're not as many people hear your music. But if you do, you're going to give up something to those folks. You know, not just financially, but just I know that they want to take their they have a certain way of doing things in the music industry that is not always pure to the music. Put it that way.
Well, I think it's an understatement. I think you're being really polite there, man.
Yeah, what the hell do I care what those people think?
Yeah, you know.
Good point.
Yeah, I used to say all the time, it was a joke, but it was actually true. I'd write this graffiti, and I would say it when I'd go somewhere. I'd say, business has no business in the music business. So I think that to take what we do as music and turn it into business, it's okay if you turn it over, if the people doing it also understand the music and understand. And here's whatever always gets lost in this conversation. We do see a lot of complaints about music business people not understanding the music. That we've seen for a long time. Even Frank Zappa talked about that. But what we don't get is, and is equally true, is that a lot of times the music business people who don't understand the music, they also don't understand the public. They don't understand the important, not from a marketing perspective, they kind of understand the public and the marketing. They have all these kind of cool words like demographics and stuff like that, which I never knew what it meant when I was young. I don't know what they were saying. But they have all these words like that because it's always related to how many pieces can I sell or how many tickets can I sell. They look at the audience as being, you know, receptacles that they could somehow go give something to and get something back from. But I'm talking about understanding the actual listener. They don't look at the audience as being part of it. They look at the audience as being almost to be used by it to make it all work, like fuel. And I don't look at it that way. So when you put that kind of mentality, the power into the hands of someone who has that mentality, something's going to give. Something's going to go the wrong way. It's like, do you guys play hockey or follow it?
Yeah.
Okay, so look what happened to hockey. It's sort of the same thing. You know, Gary Bettman looked, and the owners looked at the league very differently than, let's say, the players do or we did growing up playing hockey. So all of a sudden, hockey has become really about money. And when I used to watch hockey shows when I was a kid growing up, the talk between periods was about a guy's abilities or his slap shot or how did Bobby Hull do this or Guy Lafleur, whatever, Wayne Gretzky. Now the talk between periods is about the salary cap and who's making this and who's on the bubble and who might not get a contract. It's all about the business. So why is that even interesting to hockey fans who actually like the game? So the game has taken a back seat to the making of the game. And it permeates everywhere. It's not just Gary and the owners. It's the television people. And You got look. I don't want to see Ron McLean sitting on TV talking about salaries. I want to hear about the game and the players. You know, like that's what I want to see. And that's sort of what's happened to sport, and it's happened to music. It's all become about money, and it's all everyone's forgotten the actual game itself. And they say they haven't, but really they have. They've put it on the back burner. Let's put it this way.
It's interesting you say that, because when I now that you mention that, I can't think the last time that I saw or heard about a movie that was coming out that I didn't hear about the budget.
Yeah,
you know, like really, what does it matter?
Yeah, what does it matter? And so the story doesn't matter anymore, you know, and just the fact that the budgets of the movies went up to 200, 300, whatever million they're spending on these things. Why did they? It wasn't because they were paying a ton of salaries to people. It's because they have a lot of CGI and they have a lot of tricks and they have a lot of stuff that people are going to go get the wow factor in the theater. What happened to a good story? You know, what happened to simply writing a good story and having actors actually play it out properly, like a good hockey game that's good and honest, you know? I hate keeping to come back to hockey, but it's my, you know, play sport. But,
yeah, know. I mean, you're right. Like, everything became secondary to the money, and it's just like, sure, I mean, you can have a good hockey game, you can have a good movie, but they're largely overshadowed by the money that's going on, for sure.
Yeah, it's almost like I find that like almost insulting to the game itself and to the movie itself. If you could think of the game as having its own life type of thing, like imagine it was something that was alive, you know, because music has a life. I can tell you this when I'm creating a song, let's say, and recording a tune, a lot of musicians will tell you this if they're honest. You're in the studio and you've got this idea that you're going to do a song. And, oh, I think it's going to be like this. And you got the chords and you're putting your overdubs in and you're putting your melodies in. But what ends up happening is it always ends up being different than what you thought it was going to be. It takes you somewhere. So you may have planned to go in there and play it a certain way. But by the time the mix is done, by the time all is said and done and you diverged here and you diverged there and you added this, oh, hey, let's go get a tambourine. You know, you hear that all the time. Okay. And by the time you've done all that, you've got this kind of very different finished product that you thought it would be. And it has a life of its own. You had no idea it would look like that or sound like that. You had kind of an idea. I guess like when someone has a kid, they have kind of an idea what the baby will look like, but then it kind of looks different and it grows up. And you could never see in the grown-up, if you'd have only looked at the baby, what the grown-up was going to look like. But you can certainly see it the other way around. So that's what happens with music. And that was what I mean by it has a life of its own. And that life, that sacredness, however you want to look at it, not to put too fine a point on it, is what gets insulted when it isn't utilized properly. It's, you know, at the risk of being too harsh, okay? If we, you know, make an analogy that giving birth to music and then doing something to it later that's not good, if we you make an analogy that that's like giving birth to a person that you're going to raise to be a hooker, okay, or something like that. Hey, you know, let's have some babies so that when they're older, we can have hookers to sell. It's like it's kind of an insult and a stain to the person. It's a stain to the whole idea of having the baby. So that's what I mean when I say it insults music when it gets mistreated that way or only sold for money. The intention behind it is not good. And I get a lot of kids that come up to me and they say, you know, what do I need to do to have a great band or to be in a band? I said, you need to do it for the love of it. You need to be ready to do it for free just because you love it. And if it happens to do well, that's like a bonus that you shouldn't expect. It really needs to be that. Your motivation needs to be that. And if it is, you will be good at it. I don't care who you are, you will be as good as the guy you think is great if your motivation is pure at the beginning. And if you keep your motivation that way, that's sort of the way I look at it. It's not about, you know, planning to make it successful. If that's your thing, planning to make it successful, sooner or later, the public will see through that, and you'll be viewed as an imposter.
Well,
you know, there's it's interesting you say that, because I mean, I'm just thinking back to bands that were put together for just commercial reasons. You know, the boy bands, even a band like the Monkees, you know, for a television mm-hmm. show. You know, band like Kiss, you know, who goes in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But no doubt about it, everything they did was to try and commercialize themselves. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how do you feel about bands like that or those type of things? Because it seems like they're just such a different attitude from what you're talking about here.
Well, I'm an iconoclast, okay? So I'm a kind of a guy known in the industry among my peers as being a guy who'll pretty much call a spade, and I get in a lot of trouble for it, believe me. But I'm not really, when I'm commenting on it, I'm more commenting on in a general sense. So I'm not going to pick out Kiss or this band or that band. But in a general sense, I think that you ultimately get what you want. So if your motivation is to, we're going to go create widgets and sell widgets, and we know that widgets sell really well in northern Alberta, and we're going to do everything possible to get that, then in the end of the day, you get your reward. You end up with exactly your reward. If you think you're going to dress it up and say that your widgets were really some form of saving the world or curing cancer, you're a fool, because it's not, okay? It's not, but you're getting your reward. You wanted it. If you wanted to do it for commercial success and you know, you contrived it and you picked stuff up that way and you had totally those motivations, more power to you. You ended up doing it and you got your success and you got your reward. You're entitled to do that. You're entitled to. What I don't think you're entitled to do is tell people that it was a different thing. And you know, you're not entitled to lie, is what I'm basically saying. Mm-hmm. And you should be honest about it. You should own it. There's nothing wrong with actually owning what people do. I find too many people, if a person does something that other people might not think is cool, but then they try to make people think that what's uncool is cool. They're trying to have it both ways. I don't think that's all right. But listen, there's nothing wrong with a group that wants to contrive stuff and put on makeup and do all this stuff because they think it's going to make them money, because at the end of the day, they'll be right and it'll make them money. They've got what they started for. But don't sit around later and say, we are the artist. <You know? laughs> I mean, I have an expression that I use all the time. Are you familiar with the equipment that is boutique? They call it boutique amplifiers.
Oh yeah.
Pedals.
Yep.
You're familiar with what I mean, right?
One of us is.
Yes.
Yeah. So the boutique amplifier industry or the boutique pedal industry, and by the way, full disclosure here, I build all my own stuff, so I'm an electronics guy. I know what I'm doing when it comes to this. I'm not just a guy who, I don't think I bought a pedal in a long, long time. So I build my own amps, I build my own pedals. I'm known to do that. So my comment is this. In the industry of, let's say, guitar amps and pedals and all of the accessories that we use, even the instruments, there's a certain faction of the industry that sells what they call boutique gear. And for lack of a better description, what that means is better gear, okay? Well-made, you know, hand-wired, designed by a certain person, you know? And you obviously, you pay more for that, right? So the boutique amp, they'll charge some kid $4,000 or $6,000 for a 25-watt, you know, but wow, is it ever a great amplifier type of thing. That's the whole point. Or a fuzz pedal that's $450 or $500, but it's the boutique one. It's the real good one. And, you know, everybody's got to have it. Now, I'm telling you as a guy who builds gear that the difference between the boutique amp and the non-boutique amp is not as great as the financial difference that's being asked.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really boosted with the word boutique. Okay. That's basically a marketing thing. Okay. So if you open up a Bogner or you open up, you know, a Fender Twin, you're not going to see too much difference in electronically in what's being done. The difference is not as great as people think it is, right? Especially this goes especially for fuzz tones and pedals and, you know, wah-wahs and stuff like that. They're really not very different at all. As a matter of fact, oftentimes the boutique stuff is a stolen circuit from an earlier circuit that was already made by, you know, Gibson or Fender or somebody else or Marshall. So I tell my friends in the boutique industry, whom I have a lot of, I say, why are you charging that much money? They say, why shouldn't we? We've got a lot of R&D in it. We want our money. We want to make our money. We're not going to sell as many pieces as Ibanez or somebody else. I say, well, that's true. But have you considered that they are good things. These are good items. I'm not saying they're crappy items. They're good. I said, but have you considered that you're only making the good item available to those who can afford it? And generally, since the music industry is fueled by youngsters between 16 and 22, that's when the person's most creative, let's say between the ages of 16 to 25. That's when all the great music is written by young people. Now you're not putting the best tools into the hands of those who could actually further the industry with that gear. You're giving it to blues lawyers. And a blues lawyer is basically, you know, the guy with a lot of income that can afford to buy that amp, but he only plays it on the weekend in his blues band. I said, so what are we doing to the music industry itself, contributing to it in such a way to take the greatest tools out of the hands of the potentially best inventors and only giving it to people that can afford it? We've created like this kind of dual class system, and the young people end up not getting it. So or is it any wonder that they end up trying to make music on computers? You know, they're not given the better instruments. Try to buy a really good guitar today, what they call a, not boutique, but there's another word for it there, signature series guitars.
Mm-hmm.
They're charging what? They're charging ridiculous numbers. And these are good guitars, don't get me wrong. They're made well. But really? $3,000? $4,000? And then if you want the old stuff, oh, $25,000.
$6,000
from 1962 Fender bass, you know, 61 and a half SG like mine. Ridiculous numbers that young people, I paid $75 for my guitar. And it wasn't a lot of money at the time. You know, so we made music because we had good gear. And we didn't have all the diversions of our iPhones or anything. There weren't such a thing. So we took it and our generation made all this music. But once you've made it impossible, now you've done a disservice to music in general. And when I say this, I told you, I get in trouble. My friends get mad. You know, why are you saying these things? You're making us look like, you know, Scrooge or bad guys. They're not bad guys, but they've got bad ideas. Okay, it's a bad idea of how to keep something going. I think we should do. It's the same in hockey. We love hockey, but where are the players coming from? They're coming from the minors. So you want to make sure that the minors, the kids, when they're coming up, are given the right tools to be able to play the game, and that includes how to play the game. That's being lost too.
And it's also not a cheap sport.
No, it's not. It's crazy. It's not a cheap sport. So there's an issue going on right now with my band because I'm going back on the road. I haven't been on the road for a long, long time. In the time since I've been on the road and now, bands are doing a thing that they never did before. They're offering VIP tickets. Now, I didn't ever do that, okay? It was like if you were leaving a gig and someone wanted to say, hey, Frank, he'd say, hey, and can you sign my album? And you'd sign his album, and it was just normal, right? And if you did it, you did it, and if you didn't, you didn't. It was just normal. Now, if you want to get that happening, bands are selling these special VIP tickets, which are way more money to get to go and meet the guy, take a picture, I don't do it, so I don't know what the heck they're doing, but that's basically what they're doing, okay, for these, like, exorbitant amounts of money. And they said, so just as a matter of course, you know, the agents would say, so are you putting out the VIP tickets, blah, 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 blah. And I go, what are you talking about? Well, you know, we can make a lot of extra money because we sell the VIP tickets and after the show and you're going to sit at a table or you maybe meet them at your sound check. I'm going, wait a minute, man. I said, really, VIP tickets? I said, you know, by implication, you're creating an LIP ticket? He says, what do you mean? I said, you're creating a less important person. You know, the other guy can't afford $600. I mean, what are we doing? First, is that weird? We're in a hall. We're playing to a bunch of people, but only half of them can afford to go to the party, if you want to call it.
Oh.
And the other half got to go home. It doesn't make sense to me. It's look, I understand how it works. I get it. I get the financing of it. But why do that at all? Well, you know, it gets us to pay for our buses, and it gets us to be able to tour and do more touring and blah, blah, blah. I think that's a crock. I think it's just like they think they're going to make more money. You know, so are we really doing that now? I says, I'm not doing that. I'm not gonna contribute to even further, like making sure that some people can't, you know, can't see us or say hello to us because they didn't pay the money. They paid the money to see the gig. That's what they paid for. Why are we going further? It doesn't make sense to me, guys. So I get in a little trouble for talking about it like that. And the trouble I get in is basically from the other bands, you know, people in other bands that call me up and say, you know, why are you saying this? You're making us look like bad guys. I says, well, maybe the shoe fits. You know, maybe you got to kind of look at this. We don't want to start create two classes of supporter. Where would we be? Where would any band be without its supporters? I don't like to call them fans. Where would they be without their supporters? Let's really be real here. At the end of the day, they'd be nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
They're not saving the world. They're not curing cancer. Really, they aren't. We aren't. It's great that we do what we do. We bring happiness to people, whatever. That's good. I'm not denigrating that. It's good. But it ain't bigger than it is.
Yeah.
You know, let's be real here. We're lucky. We're very lucky. I'm very lucky to be 65 years old and have gotten into the music industry at 15. So it's like 50 years, I actually get paid to do something I'd have done for free. We're all lucky. We're all very, very lucky. We should be happy about that. And we should never discount any kind of supporter and say, well, you know, he doesn't have the money, so he doesn't get to come. You know, he can't afford what the other guy can afford, creating two classes. I never even agreed with seating when it changes price. You know, they give you the $30 ticket and the $50 ticket. I mean, I know I have no control over that. The promoters do that. The band doesn't get to tell the promoter what to charge the ticket. That guy decides what he's going to do. And he sells you the $30 seat or he sells you the $50 seat because it's close up. And that's been going on in more than just music, you know, for a long, long time, in fairness. But let's not start and taking that to the next level and starting to do it because they get to come and say hello. And I told a couple of friends of mine, I said, you know, when you were on the up escalator, you wouldn't even let these people, even if they wanted to pay, they couldn't come and talk to you. You know, you were so famous, right? You'd run from the car to the back door of the hall and you'd make sure no one could even look at you, pretending you were the Beatles. And now that you're on the down escalator, you're inviting them in to pay money to see you and saying, hey, so nice to see you. Thank you for supporting me and let me take your money. And they come and they sit on your knee like you're Santa Claus and tell you what they'd like for Christmas. That's just not me. I can't do that, guys. I'm sorry.
So I'll be sorry for that.
I get in trouble for saying these kind of things. I guess I'm kind of like the Don Cherry of rock and roll here.
Well, it is really interesting because I know that I've commented to Mo multiple times about how I'm really glad that we went to a lot of concerts when we were younger because now they're so expensive.
They are. I mean, I heard they were because I haven't been in it for a while, right? How long has it been, guys? My last concert was years ago.
Yeah.
So I don't. And then I'm hearing all these numbers. I'm going, what? What? Oh, I heard that, you know, Eric Clapton and Ginger Baker got together with Jack and they're doing a Cream concert and it's $1,000 a ticket at MSG. And I'm like, really? What? Like, did I just wake up and see this weird thing? Oh yeah, they're doing this, they're doing that. And there was one festival they were charging, I don't know what it was. It was in California. They were charging, I think it was $2,400 or $1,800 to $2,400, and you get to go to each of the days, and I don't know, you get a hot dog or something. I don't know what they were getting for this money. But look, I'm not a rich guy. I never made money in the music industry. I don't even own a home, you know? So I can't imagine what it would be like if I wanted to go see someone and have to pay $1,000 for a ticket. I just wouldn't go. So who ends up going? The blues lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
That's who ends up going. They can afford it. They have disposable income.
When did music become for the elites?
We wrecked
right?
it, man. And we're the ones at fault. We wrecked it. I include myself in that. Mm-hmm. You know, we wrecked it. We should have maintained what it was and kept it being what it was, because the difference now between supporter and artist is there's a chasm now. There's a huge chasm. And you know, the more lights and the bigger screens and the bigger light shows, and it's all a spectacle now. When I started, no one ever called it a show. They called it a concert. When I started in the 60s, it was like, are you going to the Grateful Dead concert? Are you going to the Jimi Hendrix concert? Are you going to the Doors concert? That's what they were called. No one said show. The show became later. It became a spectacle. And step right up, the greatest show on earth. That's how they were all selling it, like P.T. Barnum. And it got worse and worse and worse, and here we are today. So is it any wonder that it's very hard to find the glut of good music? There's some good new music, some there is, but not the amount that there was six in the 60s and 70s. There was so much good music in the 60s and 70s that you didn't even listen to some of the good music because there wasn't enough time
mm-hmm.
in a day. There was a lot of stuff. Now, it's kind of few and far between, and that's because it's too expensive. Same thing you said about hockey with kids. You know, I listen, we didn't grow up with money, and I wanted to play hockey and couldn't because we didn't have money.
Yeah.
So I ended up playing music. You know, because a guitar and an amplifier cost nothing. There's three channels on TV. There's nothing else to do but go to someone else's house and play in the basement. That was a lot of fun. It was like kids taking their PlayStations to their other friend's house and playing with their friends on their PlayStation. They're not doing it so that they can be programmers. They're doing it to have fun. The fun is no longer there. It's all a big business now. That goes for sport. Goes for music, goes for everything. That doesn't mean it can't be the way it was. It can. It just takes a few people to do it that way. Doesn't mean it'll be everywhere, but at least it'll be somewhere. And I really respect the guys that do it that way, quite honestly.
Was there ever anything about the actual music industry part that you did find fun? Was there any promotions they came up with that you thought, that's really cool, I enjoy doing that, or anything like that? Or is it always, or was it just some really stupid ones you came up with when you looked at them and said, oh, what are you guys doing? Like, how did
for me, I started in 69-70, okay? So just after Woodstock, okay? So what do you think where do you think I thought I was going? I thought I was going to Woodstock,
yeah.
Right? So that I thought, oh, this is going to be Woodstock, right? My life, that's what it's going to be. Woodstock every day. and when I got there, it ain't Woodstock. You know, I'm reminded of the guy saying, this isn't Kansas.
Yeah, you know?
Right. And so every day it was and I thought, well, maybe that's just this one. Okay, next week it'll be better, you know? And then it was the same, or it was worse. And as the years went by, it was more and more disappointing. So I'm an artist who, and I hate to use the word artist, guys. I'm a musician. Got to correct myself all the time. I'm a musician who in the early 80s was on a major label. Records were out there. We were playing festivals all the time. We were playing to huge crowds all the time. And in, let's say, 82, 83, I don't remember exactly the year, I'd had so much up to here that I just left. I went to the label, said, I'm not making any more records for you. I went to the manager, said, I'm not going to be managed anymore. I'm just going to do what I want and play where I want, when I want. And they said, oh, you're just lying. You're not going to do that. And I did. And I've done it that way ever since. I walked away. I tried that for 10 years, and it was still no better. And so in 93, 10 years later, I said, I'm going to go home and have children. I'm not going to play in the music industry anymore. I'll record. I'll have kids. And I was completely out of it. And then in 97, 98, they called me up for the Ottawa Blues Festival. They says, well, we're doing Canada Day. You know, would you like to play there? I says, hey, wow, can I get to play O Canada? They said, yes. I says, okay, I'll play. And I went and I did that. And after that, I started to get the odd offer. Will you play 10 gigs here or 5 gigs there? So I would do 5, 10 gigs a year, not 200. You know, I'd go where it was fun. I'd go where it was normal, where it was just a kind of a sort of a normalcy, because I really wasn't very enamored with the way the business had become. But I'm a person that if I say I'm going to do something, I do it. I mean it. I'm not bluffing. I'm not trying to make it, you know, fake. So when I walked away, I did walk away. Now, you asked me, was there ever something that, you know, you really liked about it? The best day was when I walked away.
That's telling.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't happy. For the whole 70s, I wasn't happy. I was always hoping the next, it would change, you know, into what, I was always hoping it would turn into Woodstock. It didn't turn into Woodstock. The camaraderie wasn't there. You know, musicians hanging with musicians and making music, even though they weren't getting paid, just going over to someone's place, hanging out, making tunes, you know, jamming, setting up in a park and just playing for free or whatever. That wasn't there. It was getting farther and farther away, and musicians were becoming more separated from their audience. Now, this was really bugging me, because I thought it was going to be the other way around. I thought it was going to be what I thought it was in the mid-60s, in the late 60s. And it wasn't. And I get it. Things have to change. I'm not saying they should have stayed exactly the same. I'm not stupid. But I think that people really started to take themselves seriously. And once the magazines started, because then all of a sudden there became this whole time when you had, you know, Circus and Cream and Rolling Stone and Hit Parade and all these magazines, it was all about, oh, you know, we got on the cover. You didn't get on the cover. You know, it was all about that. It's all about how famous you were, until it got to the point where people were famous just for being famous, like Paris Hilton, you know, people that really did nothing, but they're famous because they're famous. It didn't mean anything anymore. So I walked away. I thought, it's not worth it. And I was very happy to do it, man. You know, I'm just as happy playing here as I am, let's say, playing to a bunch of people in a gig. The reason I still go out and do the gig is because I owe it to the people who supported me. That's why I do it. I don't do it because I think, wow, I'm going to get bigger next year. My eye isn't on how good it's going to be for my career. I couldn't give a damn about a career. I do it because that's what I do. And people said that they're going to support me, and they actually spent their money. They went and bought my Blu-ray. They paid for it. Well, I'm going to tell them, no, I'm not going to play for you unless you pay an exorbitant amount of money. No, I'm just not made that way, guys. I'm just not. I'm pretty Canadian, eh?
A lot of what you say speaks to me, so I get it. You know, yeah. It speaks to me.
Did you see the tennis just a couple of months ago there, the Canadian girl that won the tennis thing? Mm-hmm. Remember, yeah. She beat Serena, or she beat the, I don't know if it's Serena or her sister or whatever. I think it was Serena Williams.
Serena. So this, I don't Canadian remember the girl's girl, name,
she, yeah. Yeah, I don't remember her name now, but she's Canadian. So she wins. She wins, and on TV, she says, I'm sorry I won. I know that you guys wanted Serena to win.
Yes.
I said, oh my God, how Canadian can you be? Sorry, I won. That's so Canadian. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Go oh, yeah. It.
You'll see. It's there. I was like, I said to my wife, look at this. I says, can you get any more Canadian than this girl? Yeah, sorry I won. I know everyone wanted Serena to win, but, you know, I'm sorry I had to win. It's funny. And that's me. I'm just your average guy. That's the way I look at it. That's the one thing I liked about the players in on hockey teams. You know, they're self-deprecating. They don't all come on like they're superstars. You know, they're always very self. I love Gretzky for that. You know, I love the guys that when they gave an interview, they always sort of joked about themselves. You know, they're well brought up. They're good boys. You know,
I remember when Donovan Bailey. You know, he wins the. He beat Michael Johnson in that 150-meter race, and he talks a bunch of trash about him. And Canada, instead of celebrating him, all of a sudden was, he's really mean. He's being so mean about this race he won. And Donovan Bailey was the exact opposite of what normal Canadian athlete is. You know, right.
Guys, we live in the Great White North here, so, you know, we kind of see things a little differently. But I'm also American, really, in a way, because I spent so much of my life in America. So I'm kind of an honorary American. A lot of my, 80% of my career, if not more, was spent in America. So that's my country, too. But at heart, I'm still the guy that grew up next to Dickie Moore. I mean, Dickie Moore was my neighbor from the Canadians when I was a child. And I was, you know, I grew up, you know, doing the things that Canadian boys do. And I still have that mentality in my heart because, you know, I was raised that way. I happen to be, okay, I'm a little different in that I'm a religious guy. There's not a lot of religious guys in our industry, but I am. You'll find religious people in music, but they're usually in Christian bands or something like that where they sell their religion. But I'm just this way, and I happen to be in rock and roll for quite hedonistic sort of background, but it's not me. I just happen to be in it because that's where loud guitar ends up. But that's what I do. I play loud guitar, you know. But I'm overall picture, you know, if you said to me, okay, now you're 65. You've come to this point in your life in music. Give me the scorecard overall. Yeah, it's all good. There's a lot of bad, but there's more good than bad. There really is. So if we dwell on the bad, then we're going to think it's all bad. I like to sort of say it's all good. You know, I asked a person just the other day, they were saying, oh, everything's terrible, everything's bad, everything's terrible. I says, well, let's examine if that's true, because nobody ever does, right? They just say it. I said, what do you mean? I said, well, what time did you get up today? He says, oh, I got up at 10. I says, and it was like about midnight when we were having that conversation. I said, so how many bad things happened to you today? He says, well, none. I said, okay. What about yesterday? He goes, well, none. I said, well, how about the day before? He goes, well, I got stuck at the traffic light and I got late for something. I go, oh, okay. You had a bad thing. I said, how long did that last? He goes, about 5 minutes. I said, the ratio of bad in your life is really quite small. If you just multiply it by 365, that's the amount in a year. And if you multiply that by 80 years, that's the amount in your life. So it's really not that bad. We tend to look at it and say, it's bad, it's bad. It's 50-50. It's not 50-50. If it was 50-50, we'd be killing ourselves. You know, it's like it's not. When you actually, I said, let's really look at it. No one ever does that. You ever want a Volkswagen and then all of a sudden you start seeing them everywhere?
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, or you want a Camaro and all of a sudden you start seeing Camaros everywhere. It's not like the Camaros decided, hey, there's Frank, I'm going to show myself to a boat. You know? I mean, they were all there the whole time. You just didn't notice till you started looking at them. And it's the same thing with this bad shit. Excuse me, maybe I shouldn't say that word.
Totally fine.
Nah, it's okay. It's fine. Okay?
But it's the same thing. Okay, yeah, I'm talking to you about bad things in our industry. And I'm saying, well, this was no good, and that was no good, and the gear was no good. I sound like I'm complaining. Well, it's because I'm picking them out. But if you ask me about the whole picture, the bad parts are like a few poppy seeds on a bagel. That's basically what it is. It's not as bad as we say it is. But I wish it was all better. Yeah, we always want it to be better. But hey, you make your life, right? You can look at it the way you like. I'm going to go on stage. You know how many bad notes I'm going to play in a gig? I'm going to play quite a few bad notes. But the gig is pretty long, okay? Not every note is a bad note. Why should it be perfect? It has to be human.
And do the fans look at you and say, like, oh, Frank was playing 80 bad notes in that show. That's not
well,
a good
you know
show.
What? No, listen, there's a certain type of listener, okay? And they're not usually the regular fan. There's a certain type of listener that's going to look at you critically, okay? And so they're the ones looking for the Camaro, okay? And they're going to see them, right? And they're going to add them up. That type of fan is usually not a fan. That type of fan is usually a musician. So when you ask me about what is the industry like, that's the backstage life. That's the inside baseball thing, okay? So among guitar players, for instance, you're going to get the most... I'm a guitar player, so the most critical people are going to be other guitar players in other bands. That's just natural. That's what's going to happen. And you're not going to see a whole lot of drummers from other bands being that way to drummers. I don't know why that is. I'm also a drummer, but for some reason, drummers have a greater camaraderie between each other. But yes, among guitar players, you're going to get that kind of criticism thing. I used to joke that I could always tell who the guitar players were at my concerts because they're the ones standing at the back of the room with their arms folded. Okay, so I can point them out from the crowd, and I'd say to Peter on stage, and who's my bass player, I'd say, Peter, guitar player, 12 o'clock. Guitar player, 10:30. You know, but I'm just joking, really. I'm making light of it, but it's true. You know, there's a grain of truth in it. And so there's going to be the people who look at it critically, but that's not a bad thing. You know, they're entitled to do that. If that's what floats their boat, that's cool. You know, I get it. I look at it as funny. A lot of things are funny to me. So I look at it as an idiosyncrasy of our industry that we have that. What I don't like and what was really getting me down when we were doing all the festivals was when you're playing festivals, invariably there's a lot of other bands. And so you spend a heck of a lot of time backstage waiting for you to go on or, you know, watching the other groups. And I would see these parades of guys sometimes coming down the stairs or whatever from their show or from their gig, and they'd be saying stuff like, oh, man, the audience sucks. You know, you've heard that before. Oh, the audience sucked, or the audience was great, or the audience was this. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, this is like a weird kind of thing, as if the audience is some kind of monolithic one person, right? The audience sucks. It's so weird to say that. Okay, so they didn't clap for you, or maybe they didn't cheer as much as you would have liked, but maybe that's because you didn't do something right, you know? Like, how can an audience suck? I don't see how that's possible. What, did they all get together and call each other before going there and saying, make sure you don't clap when the guy doesn't do this thing right? It's not like they're all in on it. They're just people at the end of the day. And but for the grace of God, thousands of those people in the audience could very well be one of the guys on the stage in the band. Think about it. If I go to a professional hockey game and the goalie goes down and the backup goalie goes down, they can't ask the crowd, could you please send us a person who could play goal? It's not going to be able to do it from the crowd. But if you do it at a rock game, you know, hypothetically, or a bass player fell down, is there anyone in the crowd to come and fill in for him? He'll come down and fill in for him. You get 2,000, 3,000 people that can do that. So, but for the grace of God, those 2,000 didn't get chosen to be in that band. They just weren't there at the time that guy was hired. So we're lucky to be there. We're very, very lucky because it could have been anybody else. So we shouldn't walk around as if we're the only guys that could be here. We should be grateful. And unfortunately, a lot of the times we're not. When it doesn't go well, we blame the crowd. I don't go for that, man. It's just not normal. I think it's psychotic, actually. You know? At the end of the day, if I come to your house and we play, let's say, do you guys play instruments?
I play guitar.
Okay. So let's say I come to your house and you say, oh, Frank's coming over, and you pick up your guitar and I pick up one of your other guitars and we sit around and we invent stuff. Okay. Are we really going to have any less fun than if we did it on stage? No.
Nope.
It's the same thing. We're a couple of guys playing guitar and we're having fun doing it. We're laughing and we laugh at our mistakes, right?
Yeah.
You play your guitar. Don't you laugh at your mistakes? Your friends laugh because you made a mistake. It's funny. It's not like to be, you know, called names for it. It's like, oh, I screwed up. Sorry. Ha ha. You know, it's supposed to be fun. And then we had this whole thing where, you know, you had to be the writer, too. You had to be the artist. Oh, he's a great player and he writes good songs. Like before the Beatles, nobody wrote their own songs. All the greatest artists of history, they were playing songs written by others. And it was okay. There's nothing wrong with that. As soon as the Beatles came along, oh, no, now you have to be original. You have to write your own stuff. You can't do someone else's tune. It was like a bad thing or something. And that's weird. Because let me tell you, when you go to your family at Christmas and there's a piano or whatever, and you sit around playing songs and laughing and having a good time, no one says play your originals. Okay, we're gonna say play Nowhere Man or, you know, She Loves You or something that everybody could sing along to with the wrong words. And it's fun. That's music. That's when you're in a band, when you're making music and you're smiling doing it and you're having fun doing it and you're just as happy with your mistakes as you are with when you get it right. There's not a guitar player out there that won't agree that when he was learning his stuff, he learned almost everything he learned by mistake.
Yeah, right.
He made a mistake, and it was a cool line that reminded him of a line in some song he'd heard. And he went, wow, check this out. And it became part of his repertoire. And a little more, and a little more, and a little more, like a tree growing with branches. And at the end of the day, he's that guy. He's the culmination of all the mistakes he made that he kept, that he thought were mistakes at the time, that were really cool and funny, and he came about them by accident. He discovered them. He didn't invent them. He discovered them. We discover lines. We discover chords. We discover songs. And if you discover something, it means it was there before you were. That's what the word means. And as long as you're true to that, then I think you're going to be okay. But if you've got some kind of idea that it's some other way than it is, then I think you're going to be a rather unhappy person at the end of the day. So that's my outlook on our music industry. Anybody can do what I do. Anybody. They just have to want to, and not simply, I would like to. It's a difference. Mm-hmm. You say, I would like to. Everybody would like to, but would like to and wanting to, that's two different things. When we see the Stanley Cup final in Game 7, it's only the team that wants it more that's going to win. It's a series of battles, and if everyone wins their battle because they want it more, they win the war. That's the way it works. So if you really want to play, if you really want to be a guitarist, if you really want to be a drummer, and you really want to be good at it, you're going to do whatever, and you will be, I guarantee you. I mean, assuming, you know, you're not, like, crippled or something, like, you know, don't have a hand, and that's obviously not true if you can't do it. But if you have the tools, you have the instrument, you have the amp, you have the friends who'll play with you, and you really want to do it, and you want to make great music, guess what? You're absolutely going to do it. No doubt about it. Will you get famous? That's another story, but it shouldn't matter any more than it matters when you play Auld Lang Syne at a party. Doesn't matter whether people are saying, look how famous they are. They're, you know, they're having a Christmas party and they're having fun. Let's go put it on TV. I mean, I think Ozzy did that. So put our life on TV.
Yeah.
And Gene Simmons, you know. The end of the day, if you don't have the tools to do that, well, you're still going to do it, and it's going to be fun. That's the way I see it, guys. And I'm sorry if it offends some people in my industry that I will say this, but I'm kind of telling you the truth here. I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
That's unbelievable. I mean, you're so correct. And again, the way you talk makes complete sense to us, I know. 'Cause,
and it should?
Yeah.